Hello, welcome everybody to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm your fearless host, Travis Hornsby, and today we are going to talk about the student loan permapause. Will it last until December 31st, 2022, and could it even get extended longer than that? Before we get into the main topic of today's show, I thought it would be fun to go to our voicemail and listen to a couple questions from podcast listeners. Remember that you can leave a question like this at studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. Our first question today is from Reed, who has a question about the optimal refinancing strategy along with interest subsidies that he's getting through the repay plan. I think a lot of you will be in this boat, so let's listen.
Here's a question about a specific federal student loan situation that other listeners may also be in, and I would appreciate your thoughts. I have been enrolled in the repayment plan since graduation to benefit from the interest subsidy while my required payments were $0 during residency due to my low income at the time. During the COVID pause, my income has increased, but my required recertification date is not until August 2023. Therefore, my required payments will continue to be zero until then, and as long as I don't make any payments after the COVID pause ends and before I recertify my income, my interest rate will effectively be subsidized to half, from about 5.8% down to 2.9%. I have looked into refinancing to a private lender while rates are currently low, but the best rate I'm seeing is about 3.5% for my specific situation. During COVID, I have aggressively saved about 1/4 of my total loan amount. This will be paid right before the COVID payment pause ends so as to apply as much as possible to the principal. Then I will continue to aggressively set aside money, which will then be paid all at once near my recertification date so as to take advantage of the interest subsidy every month during that time. I'm hoping to have half or more of the total loan paid by then. None of us know what private interest rates will be at that time, but this overall seems like a good plan to me with what information I currently have.
What a great question. And there's a little bit of a misconception there in the question. Reed talks about how he wants to make lump sum payments on his loans all at once so as to avoid losing out on the interest subsidy that the revised pay-as-you-earn plan provides. That's a misconception. So the repay interest subsidy, the way it's calculated, without getting too technical, right, is they tell you what your required payment has to be. Let's say it's $300 a month. And let's say that $3,000 a month is the amount of interest that you would have. So what they do is they take the $300 and apply it to your $3,000 a month of accruing interest in a normal environment, and you have $2,700 left over. If you cut that number in half, $1,350, I think, if I do the math off the top of my head correctly, $1,350 of the interest gets subsidized by the government, and the rest accrues to your loan balance. Now, let's say that you paid $3,000 because you didn't want any of the interest accruing, but your required payment on repay was only $300 a month. You don't actually get a $0 interest subsidy. You actually still get the full interest subsidy, which is still applied to your loan balance. The thing to know is they calculate the interest subsidy at the beginning of the period where they're recertifying your income, and they give you your payment, and they apply it no matter what. So you're not going to lose any money by paying extra on your loans, even if you have a low repay monthly payment that's required of you. Doesn't affect the interest subsidy. It helps you get a debt faster. That's a good strategy of people that are super anti-debt and worried about it. That's a really wonderful strategy. The other thing I would say is, yes, interest rates, student loans have been 0% for more than 2 years now. And you might say, well, I'm just sitting with all this money in cash and I feel comfortable holding off until the student loan pause ends to use that. If you're positive that you're going to pay down your loans, like sure you're going to do it, the only scenario where I wouldn't throw that money in the loans now is if you have something other that you're thinking about using that money for. So maybe Reed wants to buy a house. Maybe he wants to renovate his kitchen. Maybe he wants to book a dream vacation. Those would all be great reasons to hold off using all that money to pay down loans. Maybe he wants to wait until the stock market might crash if we have a recession from the Federal Reserve tightening up monetary policy for the first time in more than 2 years, or actually more than maybe even 10 years. I'm not sure. I have to go back and look. That would be a reason to hold a bunch of money in cash. But if this money is eventually to be used for student loan debt, at most, you're going to get maybe 1% in a savings account, and that's taxable income. So you're only going to probably keep 60 cents on the dollar for that. I would say if you're positive that you're going into a high paid for-profit job and that you will need to pay down your student loans, go ahead and use some of this money to paying down your principal and get into the regular habit of getting your debt amount lower. You know, there's no special reason why you would not do that. Now, in terms of refinancing, here's a great question that I got from a reader that I'll fill you all in on. This person had over $400,000 of debt. He applied for a refinance with Laurel Road a few weeks ago and locked in his rate. And so I don't know how the heck he got this, but going through our site, some people sometimes get stunningly low rates. So studentloanplanner.com/refi is the spot to go check that out. But he got a 2.1 fixed for 20 years. I don't know how he got this. Maybe this person's credit must be the most pristine, you know, of anything in the world besides a spring in Iceland or something to get that kind of a rate. That's a really good rate. So he asked, you know, should I have a couple days to decide before this rate expires, should I do this? But them probably extending the pause even further than what they've announced. And I told him, you've got to think long term here. You're talking about zero interest for the next, you know, 6 months, probably until the end of 2022. So that would be, if you're getting a 2.1 refi rate, that's the equivalent of saving 1% of your balance. That's $4,000 that you'll save. Now, if you compare, if you're going to pay your loan back over 20 years or even 10 years, if it's going to take you that long to pay back your loans, I think the interest rates will be at least double that by the time you get around to refinancing after the interest rate interest pause ends. Instead of a 2%, you'd be paying 4%. So for 10 years, obviously the interest cost declines every year as you pay the loan balance down, but you're talking about $8,000 of additional interest costs on that $400,000 balance whenever the student loan pause ends compared to if you did it now. So there's a lot of short-term thinking going on right now. People are right to be gun-shy after what's happened with the student loan pause getting extended 6 times now since the initial one was announced. I totally get that. I think that you have to think long-term, though, and say, inflation's going crazy. The Federal Reserve is now selling bonds and unloading their bond portfolio, which has caused the 30-year mortgage rate to cross 5% for the first time since 2018, when it only touched it for a couple days. And the first time it hit that rate before that was 2011. So you've got mortgage interest rates spiking right now, and you have a rising interest rate environment overall. So what I would tell you is this: if you're going to be more worried about missing out on record low interest rates than you might be worried if the president likes, you know, super aggressively extends the pause again to the middle of 2023 when he announces this new IBR plan, which one bothers you more? You have to make that decision. For me, if I had kept my loans paused this long, if I applied probably to more of the bank lenders on our site, those are the ones that right now are offering better rates. If you just apply some of the top couple that we have listed on the table, you'll see if you get a low rate. And if you get a low rate, and a low rate to me is anything below 4%, I would strongly consider it. You can at least let that offer sit for 30 days while you think about it before you have to commit one way or the other. The risk here is that you're really going to be facing really high rates very shortly. This is the exact risk that I was worried about when the administration announced the January 31st extension would be extended till May. I was very concerned that people who could get record low rates now are going to miss out on that and maybe even have double the rates that they could get if they had refinanced at the beginning of 2022. And when we're talking about double the rate, that's going to cost far more than any kind of interest pause, even if it lasts for even longer than we're expecting here. So I'll say that there's no right or wrong answer to this. We have to guess as to the direction of future interest rates, but I think that people should strongly consider, if you're planning on repaying back your loans over like a 10-ish year period or longer and you need to pay them off, you know, you might seriously look at refinancing if you get a low enough rate to justify doing so. If you're getting, you know, 5.5%, don't do it. Hopefully that rate will still be around when the interest pause eventually ends. But if you're getting something in the threes, I would strongly consider hitting the button. And, you know, the one positive thing I'll say about that is it commits you to paying the loans off. You have no other options now but to pay the loans off. And that commitment and that clarity in your financial life really does, I think, focus the mind and help you grow wealth faster, because it really motivates you to watch that balance fall and watch your assets increase. Now let's take another question.
Hi, Travis. My name is Jane. I just want to say thank you so much for your podcast and all of your insight. It has been super helpful over the years. So thank you so much. So my situation, I worked for 5 years at a nonprofit company between 2008 and 2013. I tried to get employment certification from them so that I can get those payments counted. And when I called the company, I found out that they were actually bought out by a for-profit company. They also did not have any of the employment records from anything, you know, older than 3 years old. So basically, I was told that they couldn't help me with my certification. So I'm in a bit of a pickle right now. I really don't know what to do, but obviously 5 years of payments could mean that, you know, I could maybe get my loans forgiven at this point. So I really don't know what to do here. It'd be great if you could just give me some advice on where to go from here. I don't know if there are other options. So thank you so much in advance. I look forward to hearing from you. Thanks.
Wow, is that an interesting one. So I'm going to tell a personal story real quick. I don't know if this is the hospital that you're talking about, but there was a big situation that happened in Asheville with Mission Health that's very similar to that a few years ago. So they were the only not-for-profit healthcare employer in the region of like Western North Carolina, that system was. And then they sold out to HCA Corporation, I think, which is a for-profit hospital corporation. What's funny is we were on a vacation trip there recently, and my one-year-old got really bad croup cough, and my wife was freaking out, and it was in the middle of the night. And so she's like, please take the baby to the ER. So I took her to the ER, and I took her to the Mission Health ER. And we wrote a story on the site really criticizing Mission Health for just screwing over a lot of their employees by converting from a not-profit to for-profit, which eliminated a lot of their ability to do PSLF. And I just thought it was just kind of ironic that we were there getting medical care for my daughter. And I was just really grateful that, you know, it's the practitioners delivering the medical care, not any of the administrators delivering that and making those decisions as to whether or not they're going to see her. So it's kind of a random personal story, but I thought I'd just mention that. So, you know, let's say that that's a similar situation, right? Like you have some sort of not-for-profit organization that got bought out, you know, like a hospital system by a for-profit, and now nobody's willing to sign for when you were an employee there. So the one thing that I would say is you're going to have to get creative here. Maybe you can track down an old supervisor. Maybe you can track down somebody that used to work in HR. Maybe you can just literally track down any human being that could vouch for you being an employee at that, you know, institution for that time. And if so, I would submit that. But if not, and here's just an example, because you said, you know, North Carolina, or I mean, you didn't say North Carolina, I'm just guessing, but, you know, you said, you know, it got bought out. Let's say it was North Carolina, just to give an example of the action that I would take, Jane. The senior senator for North Carolina, I believe, is Richard Burr. He's the ranking member on the Senate Education Committee, which gives him more pull than the average person, and he's retiring, but he still has a fully staffed constituent services office. So what I would do is contact, basically Google search Senator Burr Constituent Services. And you could, by the way, do this for literally any congressperson or senator, and just do that. And then you'll see the constituent services thing pop up, and you can type in the problem you're having, which is you are trying to apply for the PSLF waiver, your state institution, North Carolina State Institution, change tax statuses, which is preventing you from qualifying for this benefit that you're entitled to under the PSLF waiver with this federal agency. And you wondered if somebody from their office could help you figure out how to get relief for this form that you need to submit. You maybe could try to see if, you know, you could self-certify perhaps. I mean, obviously I would call the servicer too and ask what they would recommend. They're not going to have a good answer for you though. That would be my process, is get the constituent services office involved ASAP to try to get ahead of that October deadline when they're going to get swamped, and also see if you can maybe get an old supervisor who would do you a favor that would sign for you, or maybe even like a colleague or like a co-resident or somebody. I mean, you kind of have to get creative with this. Are you committing fraud? No, absolutely not. Like, it's not your fault they lost the employment records. So just read what the authorized signer has to be, and then maybe even include a note with your application if you think that might help, explaining your situation. You know, if you include that note, the Word doc, just one, you know, couple sentences in a paragraph saying why you're having the person sign, that might be an effective way to handle it too. Now let's look at another question.
Hi, Travis. Thank you for all you do. My question was about finding out the specific IDR recertification date for people on different IDR plans. My loans were recently transferred from FedLoan to Ed Financial. Of course, the website is not very conducive to looking about for things, and I can't seem to find my exact date for recertification. I know that I have at least until November 2022 based on the studentaid.gov website, but I just wanted a little bit more information about my specific case and if you had any information about Ed Financial or where I would be able to look for when my specific recertification date is. Thanks a lot.
Not to toot our own horn here, but for all of our consults, what we do is run your NSLDS file through our proprietary tool to show everything going on with your loans, right? So that tool is something that we could run that through that and then identify clearly, hey, this is your recertification date according to your plan. If you wanted to try to do it on your own, you could go to studentaid.gov, download your NSLDS file. It's a super long, ugly looking TXT file that looks like it's from the 90s because it probably is. And if you basically just control F IDR or, you know, income based or something like that to try to find that particular line item in the TXT doc, it should have something about recertification date in there, which probably is updated at this point, showing your date. But it sounds like you might actually just be November 2022, because if it's after November 1st of 2022, then it's just going to stay November. It's just going to stay in 2022. In reality, y'all, guess what? They're going to keep screwing with this because they're probably extending it to the end of the year. We'll talk more about that in a second. But I would just say, put off recertification, you know, until the payment pause ends. And then at some point after that, they're going to ask you to recertify your income. Whenever that point is, that's when you'll have to tell them about your higher income. So that would be the approach that I would take. In terms of Ed Financial's website not being great, yeah, I mean, I would really tell you that one of the problems that's happening right now is Department of Ed's good intentions always causing chaos. So what's going on right now is they're transitioning in the next year or two to a centralized platform on studentaid.gov, which is going to have all of the information in one place, and the servicers' websites are basically going to become obsolete, where you might not even need to have a servicer website because it's all going to be managed to that federal website. So think about the problem that this creates. If you're a servicer, Ed Financial actually just got fined $1 million by the CFPB for not telling people enough adequate information about PSLF and specifically the PSLF waiver. Some of that makes sense because FFEL lenders who earn interest income from the old program that existed before 2010 stand to lose billions of dollars when people consolidate their FFEL loans and get forgiveness immediately under the PSLF program. So they actually have like a built-in incentive not to tell you about this stuff. When they failed to tell people adequately about the PSLF program, you know, the CFPB being very aggressive now with a lot of sort of Senator Warren allies that are in those areas, levied a big fine against them. And you might say, good, you might have different opinions about that. But the problem with that is it creates this huge incentive for the servicers just to do the absolute minimum and try to avoid getting in trouble and avoid also making any investments because they're companies, right, that are just looking at their revenue and expenses. And when you get paid a flat fee for servicing, it creates awful incentives. If you're getting paid a flat fee, why would you go update your website, especially given that you know in 2023 or 2024, Department of Ed is going to deprecate your website and eliminate that website and convert everything over to studentaid.gov anyway. So it creates this awful incentive for the loan servicers to have the junkiest, most awful websites imaginable and to invest absolutely nothing in their websites during this transition. So I think this problem is going to be a big problem for a lot of borrowers where the student loan servicer websites are going to not get much update at all. They're not going to look very helpful. And then, you know, furthermore, the loan servicers like Navient and FedLoan that might already have websites up, they're quitting because one, they don't do a good job servicing federal loans, in my opinion. Also, you've got an enforcement sort of environment where these servicers are deciding to fire themselves because they just don't think it's worth it. And they're, you know, it's kind of a weird situation, right? Like, at least we have Great Lakes. So honestly, I'm just being honest, like this might be an unpopular opinion. Thank goodness that Great Lakes and Nelnet is sticking around. If Great Lakes and Nelnet decided to fire themselves because of the increased scrutiny from CFPB, you might say, oh my gosh, this guy, like, is he in the tank for Great Lakes or Nelnet? Like, what the heck? No, I mean, I don't love them by any means, but I think that they're the best of the bad servicers. And if they quit, then everybody would be stuck with, like, the student loan default owned servicer, like the Advantage Group, that's literally a company owned by the company that manages student loan defaults. Like, do we want them managing IDR? Like, I think no freaking way. Like, not for everybody. I mean, if you have to be managed by them, fine. Just know that the stuff's all going to be managed through the student aid website eventually, so it'll matter less in the future. But there's all these just bad incentives floating around, right? Like the Department of Ed won't adequately fund student loan servicing for whatever reason because it has to go through Congress. And then, you know, the administration, who's supposed to make sure good servicing happens, just uses the servicers as this punching bag for all the problems with the student loan system, some of which are their fault and a lot of which are not. And it just creates a bad experience for borrowers. So sorry if that's an unpopular opinion. I don't expect y'all to agree with everything I say, but I just thought I'd give you some sort of inside baseball as to why the servicer environment is so bad and why their service is so poor. It's just a whole bunch of problems all rolled up into one, which is maybe one reason why some, you know, people turned to us for help, because you're not getting it from the place that the American government's paying to deliver it to you because of all kinds of these bad incentives that we talked about. So now let's get into the main part of today's show. Will the student loan pause be extended into the end of 2022? I think the answer to this question is yes. How do we know this? For one, the public companies have to disclose, you know, things that could affect their revenues and earnings and, you know, things that they expect in terms of forward guidance, right? Companies are required to give this. Now, if we think about SoFi stock right now, I'm not sure where it'll be at when I talk about SoFi stock when this podcast comes out exactly, but they've been getting pummeled lately. And part of the big reason why is the continuation of the student loan pause, right? What they say in their forward guidance is that they expect the August 31st student loan pause to be extended through the end of the year. Why do they think that? Well, it's kind of obvious. You've got Democratic control of Congress. You've got Democratic control of the White House. And this latest announcement of the student loan pause, it's very clear that it's completely political. In prior announcements of the student loan pause, they were pointing to the pandemic and they were pointing to economic data. And at this point, it literally didn't try to do that at all. The pause, literally, the announcement literally said, like, we've created a record number of jobs in history. The economy is going like gangbusters. The economy is so amazing. And oh, by the way, we need to give student loan borrowers additional time to get relief. talking to like various sources I know in the student loan industry, they all say that like Department of Ed people that they're talking to or not even trying to give them like economic data to justify continuation of the pause anymore. They're literally just being direct and just saying, yeah, this is about politics. And why is that? So remember, they tried to start the payments in January 31st. They said, this is the final pause, right? And what happened? The progressive wing, obviously advocating for student loan cancellation, you know, they've sort of been ignored by the administration, who's really put them off and won't release the memo on whether or not the president has the authority to do this, either because they found he doesn't have the authority, or more likely, probably, maybe they just think that he doesn't want to do it. And maybe so he doesn't want to have that pressure on him to release a memo saying he can do it, and then he just decides not to do it. Progressives kept getting put off on this. And then what happened in January, and really at the end of the year in December, late December, what happened is you had the Omicron variant that went crazy, like with tons of cases coming out of nowhere. And then at the same time, you had the failure of the Build Back Better bill, which is really was supposed to be this administration's version of the ACA, right? This was how they were going to remake the social safety net. This is how they were going to provide so much transformational relief to people for childcare, home health care, potentially, like all these things that were going to change the social safety net. We're going to be this huge investment in those things for the American people. And then it didn't happen. The Democratic progressive wing of the party was furious about this. And I understand why. If you want a really big bill to pass and you have power to do it and it doesn't get passed by the narrowest of margins, it makes tons of sense why you'd be upset about that. And that anger centered on one thing that the administration could control, which was student loans. And that's really the whole thing that explains all of this politics, is the student loan pause is one of the very few things where the administration can basically do whatever it wants, because they have this national emergency declaration, which gives them the sole authority over this flexibility with the payments and pausing the payments and interest. Now, supposedly, according to the HEROES Act of 2003, which is where this authority comes from, you can't make borrowers better off, but you can keep them where they're at, which is how they've interpreted it to say that you can pause interest and let payments count towards PSLF and IDR forgiveness, but you can't cancel debt through that plan. That's kind of the interpretation. So I think that some of the criticisms of the student loan pause is, why haven't you provided actual relief to borrowers in the low-income side of the spectrum who could benefit from cancellation? And part of the reason maybe why probably has to do with the president thinking that he can't do that because of this HEROES Act of 2003. What does that mean for the continuation of the pause? Like, why did they not just extend it to the end of the year just right away? Like, why didn't they extend it through December 31st just straight up? Like, why did they choose August 31st? I think the reason is this. If you look back at all of the previous student loan pause extensions, there's a very, very clear approach to how this works. It's like clockwork, okay? We get about 50 to 60 days out from the expiration of the pause, and then you see the letter. The letter comes out, lots of concerned Democratic Congress representatives and senators, and the letter comes out, we're worried about the student loan pause ending. Defaults are going to spike. This is going to be bad for borrowers. The Department of Ed is not ready. Servicers are not ready. Where's the plan? In other words, step one is create panic and lobbying the administration, right? Usually they call for something really aggressive, like 9 more months or 6 more months for the pause. And then the administration comes out and says, yeah, we're concerned, so we're going to extend it for 3 months or 4 months. And they get to look moderate in doing that and not completely beholden to the progressive base. I'm assuming this is just my guess as to how they view the politics of it. And then the progressives get a wink, wink that it's just going to be continually extended. Then this process repeats again. In late March, you saw the letter come out. Lots of people were signed on to that, calling for the extension till the end of the year. Then Biden comes out a little later and says, hey guys, we're not going to give you the end of the year, we're going to give you August. And it's just like a repeat of every single pause extension we've seen. So why did the Biden administration choose August? Turning student loan payments on again would probably be politically disastrous for them, but doing an extension really doesn't get much benefit for them. So let's think about that. President's approval rating is low, even though they've continued to pause student loans. And the quotes of his chief of staff, Biden's the only president that nobody's paid student loan payments for the entirety of his presidency. If you extend the pause to the end of the year, you're not going to get political benefit from that. In fact, you might actually have a backlash because people are angry that you didn't cancel student debt like you promised. So you could get people really angry and have even lower of a turnout if you started payments again, but you're not getting any political benefit from continuing the pause, really. So that's why I think you do this extension through August 31st, and then that sets you up for an announcement, something in the order of, hey, you know, we're going to set up this idea where we're going to maybe make some big announcement right at the peak of the midterm campaign season, which is kind of what I'm thinking is going to happen. So here's my best guess of where we're at right now. I think we're going to see in like early August, I think the administration's going to say, you know what, our Democratic Party activists have convinced us, we're going to cancel $10,000 of debt for every American thanks to the special emergency that exists with the pandemic. And we're going to also extend the student loan pause one final time until the end of December to give our Department of Education time to get everyone back into repayment. I think that that's my base case for how the Biden administration might view this. Here's the problem. I don't think the 10,000 of cancellation is actually going to happen. Why do I think that? Because the 10K of cancellation will like be something that's almost like designed to fail. Why do I say that? Because remember what happened with the eviction moratorium. Biden thought that he couldn't do it. He got a lot of intense pressure from his progressive wing. And then he just did it anyway, knowing full well that a conservative majority Supreme Court was going to throw it out. But he did it because he thought it'd be politically helpful because of the pressure from the progressives. The exact same thing could end up happening for cancellation, where you see you wait to make the announcement. You don't make it now, because then if you have a Supreme Court case, it would happen well before the midterms that just makes you look like an idiot, or at least maybe not an idiot, but just like ineffectual if it doesn't pass. That's not going to help you for midterm turnout maybe. But what they're trying to do is maybe put the Republicans in a bad sort of situation while also trying to energize their progressive base, maybe making some sort of big announcement right before the midterms. Now, that could be a lot of things. It might not be $10,000 of cancellation. I could be wrong. It could be a generous new income-based repayment plan that they're going to announce. In fact, that's what President Obama did, is he announced pay-as-you-earn in the 2012 reelection campaign. So we could see something like that come out. We could see some sort of IDR waiver announcement come out. But now the administration realizes the student loan pauses alone are not enough. It's not going to get the job done. So you've got to come out with some sort of announcement to go with it. So let's talk about what the most recent announcement was paired with. It's called Operation Fresh Start. So this gives the borrowers that were in default, which is 8 million people, a fresh start in their loan repayment where they'll be able to start from ground zero and not have that default holding them back entering repayment again after the pause. Now, this is actually a major negative sign for those hoping for cancellation, and I'll explain why. Think about it this way. People in default are the ones that need cancellation the most. These are your, you know, most disproportionately lower income, underrepresented people of color, single moms. Like, this group needs the relief really badly, right? And instead of giving cancellation to this group, your plan for them is you're going to take away defaults from their record and help them get into repayment. Well, if you're going to cancel debt, then Operation Fresh Start's kind of like doesn't make any sense, because you could just cancel the debt, right? And then those people in default would not have to worry about repaying their loans or worrying about that default impacting them. You know, I don't think that I'm wrong in that. Maybe I guess you could say that the goal is to remove the defaults before you cancel it. I guess that could be a possibility. But I think that that's the plan here, is they're removing all of the barriers to repayment starting up again, and they're removing a barrier for people in default to start making payments again, which is really not a good sign, again, for people that are thinking they're just going to go down the cancellation route. Now, what is the risk, or you know, you could say benefit, obviously. Most of you probably listening to this hopefully are enjoying the payment pause. I understand some people might have refinanced earlier on that are regretting it, but you have to worry about what you can control. And we never saw the administration or the government ever do this before this pandemic, and so no one even had the idea that they could do it. Now we know, so I think we plan going forward. But I think one thing you're going to see as a result of this continuation of the student loan pause and just making this really a primarily political thing instead of a policy thing, the next time Republicans are in control, unified control of Congress and the White House, which maybe that won't be for a long time, I don't know. But the next time they are in control, get ready. Like, you might have a lot of people that just want to end the federal student loan program completely because of this. I mean, I'm saying this based off of what I'm seeing from sources, like in think tanks and on Twitter that I follow. Like, you know, I follow all these different groups from all these different think tanks to try to see where each party's thoughts are in like student loan policy. And that's what I'm reading right now from more conservative type of groups, is their plan is to just try to get the federal government out of the student loan lending business completely because of this. So all hope for compromise on like simplifying income-based repayment and loan forgiveness and a bipartisan elimination of the tax bomb, improving loan servicing, improving PSLF. I think anything through congressional action from, you know, all these student loan pause extensions that we've had is dead. Maybe it was dead already because the political environment's already so partisan, but I think it's really dead. And so I think that you're just going to see continual short-term fixes, short-term actions taken through executive orders, which is going to make student loans continually complicated and confusing. So that's maybe some sadder news, I guess. But let's talk about what would cause this pause to be extended past December 2022. Let's say the Democrats keep both chambers, which is very possible. Look at what happened in the Georgia Senate election, right? Don't underestimate the ability of the Republican Party to just blow things. So you could see, you know, you could see the House and the Senate stay in the Democratic, wing, right? Democratic control. And if that happened, then the administration won't be under pressure to end the national emergency declaration. Now, if Republicans take one of those two chambers, I think what they'll do is they'll just say, we're shutting down absolutely everything. Not a single thing will pass until you end the national health emergency order, because they've already tried to do this. The Republican Party was able to actually pass this in the Senate while some Democrats were out, and it just went nowhere in the House. But, you know, I think that they could hold up literally everything if they had control of one of the chambers of Congress until that was eliminated, which takes away the president's authority to pause student loans and interest. So assuming that Democrats keep control of both chambers of Congress, then even some progressives that I follow have talked about repayment and interest starting up in like mid-2023. And the reason they say mid-2023 is that's when they expect the Biden's new income-based repayment plan to go live. And I think that what they would do is they would say, okay, we're positioning this new repayment plan as the plan. It's going to allow so many people to pay almost nothing. and we're going to tell everybody to sign up for this one plan and start repayments with this new plan that Biden came out with. So that's the scenario, I think, where the payment pause gets extended through the middle part of 2023. Now, will it go longer than that? Will a bunch of Democrats running for president, which I think, let's be honest, I don't necessarily see Biden seeking a second term at this point. I'd be a little surprised if he did with his age. And also, I think that a lot of people, if his approval ratings were in the, 50s, I think he might try, right? But if his approval ratings stay in the low 40s to below, he's not going to probably get that nomination for a second term, which means you're going to have a bunch of Democrats running that are also going to be in Congress, and they're going to want student loans to maybe be paused through 2024. Really, a lot of things could happen with this. So I'm just trying to give you all the scenarios I can foresee. But I do think that they did try to restart student loans in January of 2022, which was, about 10 months away from an election. So middle of 2023 is far enough away from the 2024 election and also far enough away from the primary season, I think, for president, which would be like 8 or 9 months ahead of that when the first primaries would happen, right? So I think that you would see the pause, because even progressives, most progressives are either wanting cancellation to happen or they want 50K of cancellation to happen. Like even like Senator Warren isn't calling for 100% cancellation. Like the only people calling for that are like Bernie Sanders and some of the most progressive members of the House of Representatives. So even like a Senator Warren eventually thinks student loan payments would start again. And I'm hearing stuff like that from progressive think tank people. So that's my base case is I would expect Republican take over one of the houses of Congress means the payment pause will end like December 31st, or maybe they'll say January to avoid anybody getting a bill around the holidays. So it'd be like December 31st, January 31st of the end of the year, and then some sort of big announcement in August or on the midterm campaign season. So with some big new initiative Biden wants to do, like maybe making a super generous IBR plan or announcing some sort of cancellation, which I think the cancellation is more likely, because if he announces a new IBR plan, what are people going to say? They're just going to say, thanks for nothing, right? You're not canceling debt. You're not keeping your promise. So that's kind of why I think that that's the route we're going to see is some sort of cancellation announcement early August. Things get thrown into the courts because Republicans will try to block that if it's cancellation, because they basically said as much. And then I think that you would see the result would be the payments would start on schedule after the election, or they would get kicked out to middle of 2023 if the Democrats hold both of the chambers. But I think going back like many decades, the party out of power generally wins like, I think it's like 10 to 20 seats at least. And the only exception to that was 9/11, when President Bush had like a super high approval rating because of the 9/11 attacks. And so I think Republicans like had unexpected success that year because of the 9/11 attacks. Anything's possible though, right? So we just need to be prepared for anything. So you've got several months of additional money that you were thinking you might have to spend on student loans. So where are some of the places that you could put it? So I wanted to announce a really major initiative that we decided to get into. So one of the things I've been thinking about with the student loan pause just continuing is how could we use this time to expand what we do? So we have been thinking, Student Loan Planner optimizes repayment plans and student loan strategies. That's our core, but I want that mission to grow into growing wealth and financial security for student loan borrowers and professionals. That's really what I want to expand our company into, because I think it's the right thing to do. And I think if we take the ethical approach that we have for student loans towards other things that are adjacent to that, I think it's going to save you money. I think it's going to help you achieve your dreams. And I think it's going to give you additional options that will save you money from comparison shopping. So with that, drum roll, please. I am announcing that we are launching SLP Insurance LLC effective right now. This is something I've been working on for the better part of a year. You might say, SLP Insurance, what is that? We basically decided to create an insurance agency to help people shop for term life and disability insurance. The reason why I think that we can provide a competitive edge in this market is the following. Most people that operate in this space really want to close a deal. They really want to close on the sale, and it's sale focused instead of what's the best thing for you focused. So what we've done is we brought on partner agents, Matt and Pradeep. They have the mandate to only sell you a policy if it's what you actually need, and if they can't find a better discount available elsewhere, even if it results in us making nothing. what I mean by that is if you're a resident dentist or resident physician, you might have a special contract, or an insurance company agent might have a special contract through your residency program where they're able to offer an exclusive discount that nobody else is allowed to offer. And that discount might beat anything that an independent agency like SLP Insurance could find for you by comparison shopping the big six carriers for own occupation, own specialty coverage. And in that case, our job, if we know about a policy like that, is to send you to that other agent, even though it results in us making nothing, because you need the coverage and you should get it for the very best price. Now, unlike other things you shop for, you might actually be able to shop the entire disability insurance market for the most part by talking to SLP Insurance. The reason is there's only six carriers that offer true own occupation disability insurance, which is really the main thing that you should consider buying. And then there's basically policies offered directly through certain hospitals, professional associations, residency programs. And the question is can something that an independent agency offers you, can that beat that? The other thing that we do is some programs offer what's called guaranteed standard issue coverage, which is something that's guaranteed to be offered to you. In other words, it's not subject to medical underwriting. Now, the problem is if you have medical conditions and you submit a quote to another insurance carrier and you say that you have medical issues, then the option for you to get insurance coverage with that guaranteed policy through the residency program could potentially be eliminated, which is why what we do is we take that information that you give us. We don't submit absolutely anything until we verify, hey, do you have a guaranteed standard issue policy available through some sort of place? Do you have medical issues? Can we look for a policy that would guarantee you coverage without having to go through medical underwriting? Because what is the point of this? I don't care about making more money from this. I would like to, because it means hopefully we provide insane good value for you. But that's not the goal of anything we do through Student Loan Planner. The goal is to put you at the center and help you get the kind of stuff you need to be financially secure and grow wealth as a student loan borrower. So if you're thinking about disability insurance, here's the thoughts on that. Most people are not going to buy this if you're making a five-figure income. The reason is because the costs of it is generally like 100 to, it can be as much as 600 a month if you're, you know, making 500K a year or something, right? So it's expensive compared to other kinds of insurance. Why? Because disability is way higher likelihood of actually happening to you. Now, why do people buy this? Social Security disability is only going to cover probably $1,000 to $2,000 a month of income. If you are somebody who's invested years in training and you've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to get your degree, especially if you're the primary breadwinner for your family, then if something happens to you, that's the number one asset you have. You have a future cash flow of like, you know, $5 million perhaps, that if that becomes impaired, that is far worse, far, far, far worse than you losing 50% on your $100,000, you know, mutual fund portfolio. So that's why anybody who's not financially independent absolutely needs to have a disability insurance policy. Now, the reality is people that make five figures look at the cost of that policies and think, you know, I just want to take my chances with Social Security disability and hope it works out. And that's okay. But anybody who makes over $100,000 a year or will make $100,000 a year at some point, who especially works in any kind of medical related field, so, you know, medicine, dentistry, veterinary medicine, you could throw in some nurse practitioners and travel nurses into that, pharmacists, maybe even some really high income attorneys if you're, you know, making $400,000 a year as an associate in a big law firm and your spouse is a stay-at-home spouse. All of those individuals absolutely need to buy disability insurance. The problem is if you look through coverage offered through your workplace, usually that coverage is either non-existent for long-term disability or it's got bad definitions of an occupation specialty. So maybe they'll cover you if you're a paraplegic, but they won't cover you if you break your thumb and you can't do procedures anymore. The other thing that can happen is the benefits are capped. So it might be capped at like $5,000 a month, and then that might be totally inadequate for a surgeon making $400,000 a year with a family of five. So to get quotes from SLP Insurance LLC, which by the way is SLP Professionals Insurance Agency LLC in New York and California, go to studentloanplanner.com/DI, dog igloo. Also stands for disability insurance, right? studentloanplanner.com/DI. And if you do that, enter your information into our quote widget. We will reach out to you by email, or our agents will, Matt and Pradeep, and they're going to ask some maybe additional questions that they need to verify whether they should be running quotes to make sure, again, why? Because we want you to get the very best policy around. And that means we have to, if, for example, you have any medical conditions, we're going to verify some things with you first before running quotes so we don't risk any kind of jeopardization of guaranteed standard issue policies, right? But we're going to run those quotes. You can compare those to anything you have currently, or you can also ask us to review your coverage. So fill out that form at studentloanplanner.com/DI. And if you have like a Northwestern Mutual policy that's super expensive because the agent is only allowed to sell Northwestern Mutual policies that you talk to, we can review that coverage. If you don't have any coverage at all, we can review that. If you have workplace only insurance, we ask you to send that over to us and we'll review that coverage. And guess what else? A lot of times people are marketed student loan riders on their disability insurance where it'll pay up to $2,500 a month if you become disabled on your student loans. And we have the knowledge to help know whether or not that rider is useful or not, right? Because we do student loans each and every day. So I'm really excited about this. I hope you can sense that. I got into it not because I am super interested in just selling insurance. That's not the point here. The point is a very narrow insurance policy, like own occupation, own specialty, disability insurance, is extremely important for the physicians, dentists, and veterinarians out there at the minimum, but probably a lot more people. And furthermore, why am I talking about it now? In April, a lot of people either finish their training and residency and fellowship and they sign their attending deals, or they're finishing medical or dental school and then they're going into a residency program. And both of those things are triggers for you being able to get residency pricing that can be significantly cheaper than if you wait until you are established in your higher paying job, or the rates would just maybe double or even go up more than that. And also there's all kinds of nuances too. If you're leaving one state, moving to another, where you might need to rush to get the policy in place because the pricing in the state you're leaving or moving to could be higher or lower. So for one example is if you are moving to Massachusetts as a female, well, Massachusetts, I believe, has a mandatory unisex pricing rule where females in Massachusetts could qualify for a better premium, and purchasing it there than if they purchased it, say, in Texas. And the vice versa point could be true too. As a male, if you're moving from Texas to Massachusetts, you would want to make sure you lock in that disability insurance policy before leaving Texas, which does allow price discrimination based on gender. Obviously, we don't think that's a good thing. That's kind of an annoying thing that happens, but that is where it pays to have somebody who's super knowledgeable about these policies and doesn't try to sell you junk you don't need. So in my opinion, the only thing that people should really be buying is own occupation, own specialty, disability insurance, and term life insurance. The disability insurance you need even if you're single or even if you're in a relationship that you don't plan on having kids. Why? Because if somebody becomes disabled, you want your financial independence to be not related to how your partner feels about you post-disability. I'm just being, frank there, right? So you need to have own occupation, own specialty, disability insurance to protect yourself. The term life insurance is to protect dependents and people depending on your family's income only. So for term life insurance, most people have $50,000 through work. Why? Because that's the maximum that an employer can deduct the premiums for. Some places offer 2x coverage at work, which is totally inadequate if you're a professional. So you really would need to get 10 times your income in term life insurance, which we can help you get quotes through as well. If you go to studentloanplanner.com/life, you can get term life insurance quotes if that's all you're looking for. But our insurance agency can also look at this holistically for you and look at disability and term life policies for you all at once, and can maybe even use the same medical exam to get you quotes for everything all at once. So studentloanplanner.com/DI, fill out the form. This process takes a couple months, so it's a good idea to get this started if you're going to be finishing up training or school in the next few months. Great time to get that started. And we'll have more content about that in the future and other projects that we're working on to save you money too, that I'm excited to announce as we sort of expand our mission here at Student Loan Planner from just focusing on student loans to helping people that are facing the challenges of student loans to grow wealth and obtain financial security for their families so they can live their dreams. And so you can live your dream and be just confident that you have just the most amazing, brightest financial future that you could ever hope for. I'm Travis with the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Reach out to us, podcast@studentloanplanner.com. If you have any questions or comments, leave a voicemail for us, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail, and fill out those insurance quote request forms, studentloanplanner.com/DI. Thank you and have a wonderful week.